And that's exactly what I thought, Gary. Ah, well. Oh, hey, just one more question. I've been meaning to ask you this for quite some time. Does the Fourth Amendment imply a right to privacy?
Well, I think it's more fair to say that, yes, it does. And I think it's kind of specific. Now, over time, that's been distorted, but let's start with the Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. It goes on, but that's not appropriate, germane to the subject. But yes, we should have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and it prevents the government then from intruding on that privacy, at least in those aspects defined. Now, you think that was written 200 years ago? That the world has changed since then considerably. I mean. Well, I can't remember the case. It was Olmstead. It's one that Tim McVeigh referred to. It was a wiretap case, and it was kind of interesting because Washington State had a law against wiretapping without a court order, but the federal government didn't need a court order to wiretap. And the decision of the court was that since telephone wiretapping wasn't mentioned in the Fourth Amendment, it could not be applicable. Now, there have been subsequent decisions, but I thought it was interesting when McVeigh pointed out that case. The technology has brought many issues regarding privacy into a question of whether they belong within the protections of the Fourth Amendment or not. And it's not just technology. It's a very broad aspect of society where, I mean, privacy is a big concern. People are convicted regularly of identity theft, and people have had their lives nearly destroyed. That's an invasion of privacy. That's crossing this line. And putting out information about people. Now, this goes back, rumors about people. Some of the founders during the Jefferson was accused of things. Hamilton was accused of things. They may or may not have been true. This is back then, not the recent ones against Jefferson. So spurious accusations have occurred for a long time, but in none of those is there anything more than a conjecture. But now, we in the society we live in, this information is unfortunately often too readily available, where the privacy is invaded to a much greater degree than in the past. So, you know, it's got to be the beginning point in the discussion of privacy, without a doubt.
Well, there is this book I just finished reading, and I wrote a report up on it on the blog, obviously. And the author was making kind of like a set of related arguments. I guess a place to start would be that she was essentially postulating that,
well,
you know, like
what's
in the
title of the book and who's the author?
Dr. Jeannie Graham Scott's Mind Your Own Business, The Battle for Personal Privacy.
Okay.
Yeah, she was, I guess a place to start is that, you know, starting from the early American Republic to the war between the states, you know, we actually had communities, like people knew each other. And, you know, granted, while you may not want your neighbors to probably have an intimate knowledge of any embarrassing pastimes you would have, you know, they're, you know, she was saying that privacy wasn't as important.
Well, it probably wasn't, you know, if you were doing something illegal or immoral, especially in a highly religious community, especially post-revolution in some of the states or colonies, there would be a concern regarding privacy. But, yeah, not like today where it's a marketable commodity. And the utilization of private information is much more devastating. So the concern then was primarily from a criminal standpoint, perhaps a moral standpoint as well. It was basically, let's go on with the rest of the Fourth Amendment so we can get it in perspective. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. An oath or affirmation, an affidavit, is personal knowledge sworn, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Now, that implies that somebody, the affiant, who does the oath or affirmation, had knowledge. So if you divulge to somebody that, look, I've got some firecrackers in here in this chest at the foot of my bed, and firecrackers are illegal, and so don't tell anybody. Once he told them, that expectation of privacy was lost because he gave up his privacy I think I've told you this before. Sleepy, you can keep a secret, can't you?
I like to think so.
Well, I can too, so I'm not going to tell you, okay? Once I violate my secrecy and give that information to you, I have given up that right of privacy because you now can do an oath or an affirmation or an affidavit as to the fact that I have illegal firecrackers in the chest at the foot of my bed. Now, that's the specificity. If you read some of the historical things, they had to know exactly where this was, what it was, what they were looking for, not something broad. So if it was given up, it was generally given up by you. If it was given up by illegal means, somebody broke in your house and found the firecrackers and reported it, I think that now you've got a situation where you can charge that your privacy was violated by him breaking in your house and finding the firecrackers. But if you show them to him, you kind of relinquish that privacy. So when it's voluntarily given, the expectations got to change. And I think that can be discerned simply a little understanding of history and careful reading of the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, understood.
Okay, go ahead, yeah.
Well, she more or less went on to say that since the war between the states, you know, because of geographic and job mobility, gradual corporatism, but, you know, especially because of that oh-so-persnickety 14th Amendment, as well as rampant urbanization, privacy is actually kind of is actually now of a concern, especially since you have to deal with hostile strangers more so than, our forefathers did. And especially in speaking about urbanization, I mean, last time I checked, 82% of these United States, or maybe once United States perhaps, 82% is urbanized, a combination of urban and suburban, you know, cities and, you know, the gentrification. 82%
of the population lives in urban. Not 80% of the 2% of the country.
Right. Yes. So the proportion in terms of people who live in a rural area or who are otherwise able to be self-sufficient in any way that's meaningful is not anything to compare about. Which also means that everyone's like a lot more, just physically closer together. I mean, you've heard me mention before about, people driving by my window or whatever, or neighbors hitting on the other side of the wall or various things like that. And, that's normal. That's most of the population.
Most of us lived in an apartment at one point or another where you could hear the neighbors fighting, feuding, or doing other things, squeaky beds, things like that. But I'm not so sure that she's correct because think of breach of privacy back then, even after the Civil War. Breach of privacy back to moral violations, and a lot of states had cohabitation laws, moral laws much more rigid than today. So there were moral law violations or criminal law violations, but I don't see that there was a significant change in the, there may be, I mean, she's probably done more research than I have, but in those, you know, court cases I have read through that period, I don't see that there's a breach of privacy like we're looking at today. I think the marketability of privacy in the last, maybe 3 or 4 decades has probably been the area of concern. Well, we can go back to, I think it was 1930s on that Olmstead case, but which was the wiretapping. But the mark, and again, that was criminal activity, but it was breaching the privacy because they didn't mention phones in the Fourth Amendment. But nowadays, the privacy breaches are prolific, and they come from any number of sources. And we give up information. We give that information up. And so the big problem is generally we give it up. But the marketability is what's really caused the change on it, I think. So I guess I kind of disagree with what she said as far as this change after the Civil War, because I really don't see anything except during the Civil War when the spies were going both directions, north to south and south to north, which I've read quite a bit about, and they got pretty sneaky. But that was during a war, putting down rebellion, I guess, is proper way.
Well, if I had to boil it down, Gary, to what Dr. Scott was really getting persnickety about, at least a good portion of the book, if not most of it, was she seems to think that there is an inherent conflict between essentially the First and Fourth Amendments, and more specifically about the First Amendment, that concerning not necessarily free speech, but really more the freedom of the press. And she was mainly arguing a good portion of the book that the freedom of the press directly contradicts the individual right of privacy.
Well, we have to look at what freedom of the press meant and what it means now. Freedom of the press back then, John DeWitt when Anti-Federalist Papers, and John DeWitt was not his real name, again, back to privacy, secrecy, things like that. But John DeWitt said that freedom of the press, actually, I need to find that quote. The freedom of the press hath in consequence thereof been esteemed one of its safeguards. He's talking about definition of, the necessity for the freedom of the press. In consequence thereof, been esteemed one of its safeguards, that freedom gives the right at all times to every citizen to lay his sentiments in a decent manner before the people, if he will take the trouble upon himself, whether they are on point or not. His countrymen are obliged to him for so doing, for at least they lead to an examination of the subject upon which he writes. Now, wait a minute. He's talking about the press, and he's talking about people writing to the press. Now, they didn't have reporters like we do now. Most of the news back then, the freedom of the press that was talked about back then, was actually mostly reported by, I received a letter from South Carolina, here's what happened down here, and then they send this, the introduction of the letter to the local press publishes it. There was a lot of opinion in papers. We didn't get the 5 W's like we have now. We could have gotten the 5 W's if they were written into it, but generally people were opining when they wrote these articles about this is good, this is bad, things like that. So he says that every man has a right to be heard. The freedom gives the right at all times to every citizen to lay his sentiments in a decent manner before the people. Now, to me, that means the letters to the editor should be much larger in the newspaper so thoughts can be gotten out. But from my own experience, I think I get 1 out of 10. So I stopped writing letters to the editor because they don't like my opinion. They're restricting my freedom of the press, according to what John DeWitt said. Freedom of the press has changed over time. It protects the reporter from not divulging a source. And you know, maybe that's good, but it's been broadened out where it's got no relationship to what John DeWitt wrote about back in 1787. None at all. Because now it's become a shield to protect the press and allow them to do almost anything. You know, as far as libel, unless they can prove that they were deceived and provided something to support a claim that they publish, they can be found guilty of libel. But if they show substantively that they were provided what appears to be proof about the statements made in the newspaper, then the shield is in place. That's not what John DeWitt was talking about. The paper wasn't held accountable, but the reporters didn't work for the paper then. But now they're protecting the reporters, and they're protecting the editors. So we've got a change in what freedom of the press is, and it probably allows an unfair violation of privacy in some cases, because they'll use covert means to acquire information outside the law, outside of the requirement for a warrant or the affidavit and all that to achieve information. So, you know, I guess you have to determine what is a violation. Where's the line drawn on what the press can report and not violate your privacy, and where they actually violate your privacy in what they report.
Wow, I didn't know any of that before.
Well, that's why you asked me, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a good thing I brought it up, gee whiz. But yeah, it's, I don't know, when I was reading her various chapters, I kind of revolved around, you know, freedom of the press as she was defining it more like a kind of creepy, gossipy, kind of obsession with celebrities type thing. You know, she was acting like that was freedom of the press, and that directly contradicts privacy.
Well, you're talking about like paparazzi and things like that? Is that where we're going?
Paparazzi, yeah. Well, yes, she was using that as an example, but also things like, you know, if you have people who aren't public figures who get embroiled in something that's considered newsworthy, you have private citizens who, I guess, become not so private overnight. You know, they get their 15 minutes of fame, even if they don't want it. They, you know, then people want it, you know, then, well, people, I don't know who people, which people, but supposedly people want to know about, you know, their family and where they work and what they had for lunch this morning and the rest of it. At least that's how Dr. Scott was portraying it anyway.
Well, you know, we've talked about this before, but I'm going to repeat it. There are a lot of people that write things nowadays assuming that in their lifetime freedom of the press has been presented this way, that that's freedom of the press the whole time. And without going back, and you know, you've seen pictures of the bookshelf behind me, I want to know what caused these things. You know, back then they turned these things by hand to print newspapers, and newspapers were read probably by 50 or 100 people in some cases. They were posted for free outside the press office so people could read them, not like today where you pay a subscription, they throw it at your door, or you go put I guess it's a dollar now on a machine, it used to be a nickel, and lift the cover and take one paper out, and, you know, the old newspaper stands, and I don't see those very often anymore like they used to be, much more common. Without that historical perspective, I guess most people would assume that freedom of the press has been what we've seen on the news and in movies and things like that. Now, when we're talking about movies, how often do we see a movie that talks about freedom of the press 200 years ago? We might see it from the 30s, the gangster days, or something like that. So our perception of what freedom of the press is the one that I had for many years, that, hey, this is to protect the press so they can publish what they want. But look at the press. They don't publish. They publish what they want, and they don't publish what they don't want. And to me, that's an absolute violation of the concept of freedom of press that John DeWitt gave to us. So that historical perspective is is important. Now, there's another one that I think does go back to the time, because even back then, during coming elections, especially when Jefferson was coming up for election, accusations were made, and they were made by people who didn't name themselves. They used a pen name, and they would publish scandalous information, and there was no recourse. Now, if they did it against me, there would be recourse, but even back then, they had the concept of public persons. There's a point in your life, if you aspire to public office, that you're, and this goes back to the concept of gentleman, that at a certain point, when you've stepped into that realm of public service, which was service back then, by the way, not mastery as it is now, that you turned your life over to the public, and it became an open book. And so Jefferson had no recourse. All he could do is add fuel to the fire if he would have fought the accusations made against him. Hamilton had accusations made against him, these two at least I'm familiar with, and they had to do with sleeping with another man's wife and things like that, and a child out of wedlock. But they didn't fight these. They were public people, and people would either believe it or not, because these people had aspired to and achieved that point in life where they became public persons. And the same thing's true nowadays, but now, I should say in the last, a few decades ago, now it's going even further, though, because that line between the public person and the private person is being lost, and the press is a part of the extinguishment of that line where you became a public person or not. They'll talk about anybody and misrepresent things. It doesn't matter. Somebody charged with a crime, somebody that died as a result of government activity. Look what they did to the Davidians. They took the government line and accused these people of all kinds of things. And I've met the Davidians, I've talked with them, and I believe they were honest with me. And a lot of this stuff didn't happen. They weren't public persons. They were private people in their private home, their private church. And so the press, by 1993 then, is able to breach that line on public persons with immunity. So this is transitional stuff, and it's getting to the point that this whole concept of privacy is being eroded by small but incremental steps that are demolishing it. I don't know how else to put it. So,
well, yeah, and see, that's the thing, is that even... How do I say this? I mean, it's not just about, the abuse, really, I think is what you've been describing, of the freedom of the press. I mean, whether it is also, police powers of the government being much more intrusive and actually violating the Fourth Amendment, or,
or what the meaning of the First Amendment is, too.
Right, that too. Or, this expectation about, your medical records being kept confidential, which I think is naive. thinking that you have any sort of liberty at all at a public school if you're a kid, since they're indistinguishable from prisons, one that you don't have to sleep overnight at.
Let me stop you right there. Here's a classic one. This one really gets me. I still remember I was 14 years old when I started working under a Social Security card, 14 or 15. I got a Social Security card, and I still remember on the front it says not to be used for identification, and on the back it said a $50 fine for misuse of this card. Not to be used for identification. Not to be used for identification. And it has my name and my Social Security number. Now, the implication to that is that it's not to be used for identification. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. But then to sell the idea of giving people a number, what some people refer to, and maybe rightfully so, the mark of the beast, this fixed identification, not your name, but this number assigned to you. The objection to it was overcome by saying not to be used for identification. That was the law. Now the government does not intervene when Say a telephone company says, we can't give you a telephone unless you give us a social security number. A bank says you can't open a bank account unless you give a social security number. You want your electric turned on in your house, you got to give a social security number. Whatever you do nowadays, you got to give a social security number. So the government has laid the groundwork for, I don't know how to say it, for ignoring the law of the land, for ignoring personal responsibility by allowing these marketing forces that I talk about to freely grab your information in violation of the contract that I signed when I got my Social Security card. I agreed not to use it for identification, and I agreed that I'd pay a $50 fine if I used it for identification. But the government doesn't enforce it. They promote it, I should say.
Well, okay. Yeah, and that's the, what else is there to say other than, to paraphrase Judge Andrew Napolitano, the government breaks the laws that it makes and seeks to impose over the rest of us, and we're expected to follow it, even though it breaks its own rules. But how does that work? Oh, wait, that's right. It keeps carving out exceptions for itself, carving out its own little spheres. It's like with the cops or anything else for that matter. Or, hell, look at fractional reserve lending. Hell, if you do it in your basement, it's called counterfeiting. But if the Federal Reserve does it, oh, well, that's fine. You need that for stabilizing the economy or something.
You're getting into an area that's outside the realm. I'd rather not address counterfeiting and Federal Reserve notes if we're talking about privacy because it has nothing to do with it.
Well, yeah.
But I see your point. Yes, the government has laws that if you lie to them, you can be, even though you haven't sworn to your testimony, if you lie to them, you can be guilty of lying. Not perjury, but lying to a government agent. But they can lie to you. Congressmen can lie to you. Earlier today, we were talking about, the Vice President of the United States saying, shoot through the door, or go outside and shoot a couple rounds from your shotgun, and let him know it's empty, by the way. Both of those are criminal. One, in most places in this country, in the urbanized areas, it would be illegal to discharge a firearm within the city limits. The other one would be involuntary manslaughter or perhaps murder if you shot through the door and killed somebody. If it was a cop, I guess I'd get a kick out of it, but they can lie to us. They can tell us stupid things. I'd love to see somebody go to court after shooting a cop through the front door with a shotgun and use his defense. Let's call it the Biden defense. But the government told me I could do this. The second highest, most powerful man in this country told me I could do this. How can you charge me with a crime? But see, the government does run this double standard on privacy and everything else. They enacted the laws to get the law enacted, the Social Security Act, and then they breach it and give private corporations the ability to use this information. And probably the greatest breach of our privacy is the utilization of that Social Security number for just about anything. I mean, it's almost to the point that we'd be better off to tattoo it on our forehead so we didn't have to remember it.
Yeah, might as well. And like a couple other things. Corporations can use, your credit report against you. Paranoid goofs who don't know any better hire private investigators.
Just found out that the insurance companies, automobile insurance, use your credit report to determine your rate. And I'm still trying to figure out. They have what they call actuary tables. And I'm trying to figure out how your credit fits into these actuary tables to determine what rate you should pay when you're buying automobile insurance. So, yeah, where does this end?
Well, I don't know necessarily. I mean, we've got paranoid goofs who hire private investigators to surveil their lovers. You've got government spy agencies who are free, apparently, to gather intelligence about all of us for their massively growing databases. Hell, even the various government court buildings around the country themselves, I think, have more security than friggin' Fort Knox.
Well, the Committee of Safety, Orlando, Florida, when we started that, we had an application. The application said name, and right after it said, is this your real name, yes or no? It didn't ask what your real name was if you said no, but the bottom, it said, it had a place for a signature, a date, and it had a little scroll that said seal in it. Now, seal means I'm swearing to this. And this government agent, deep undercover IRS agent, that's his title. He also teaches IRS undercover agent tactics, said yes, it was his real name. His real name wasn't Robert Chapman. It was Robert Quigley. We found out in the Florida Common Law Court trial. Interestingly, he swore that he was Robert Chapman, and he wasn't. He swore when he filled out that application. He's not accountable.
Well, yeah, and see, isn't that kind of fraudulent on his part?
No, he's the government. The king can do no wrong. We have come to the point that the king and his minions can do no wrong. Every once in a while, a bone is thrown to the dogs, where they'll prosecute somebody. But for the most part, no, they can lie, cheat, and steal. They can sell guns to Mexicans and then turn in the people that sold them the guns to send to Mexico. So the king can do no wrong, and we have become a monarchy, and his minions are protected by law, and we're damned by law. That's the law, honest.
Yeah, I could believe that. And you see, Dr. Scott's book was written during the 90s, actually, so she didn't really get into any computer stuff, but I'll just say that. Anybody who's been in the alternative media for any length of time, this past decade or so, understands about all the traffic network analysis stuff and, recording of IPs and snooping, the NSA snooping into people's emails and the rest of it. We're basically living in a completely hellish Orwellian nightmare. And it's gradually, and in some cases not so gradually, getting worse. The Google Glasses thing just came out. Now, it's interesting. There was one business that has already decided to ban the use of Google Glasses. They won't serve any customers and kick them off premises if they're wearing Google Glasses. But that basically is like live streaming video to the internet that anyone can view. In a lot of ways, kind of like Justin TV or some of these other websites with live video streams.
So the business is outlawed from putting security cameras in dressing rooms because somebody might put some expensive dress on under their clothes and sneak out. But the government basically is approving Google goggles and allowing people to go in the dressing room or the restroom and send out live streaming pictures of people doing private things in a restroom or a dressing room?
I guess so. I guess the only reason it's not more of an issue is because it's still so new that it hasn't had a chance to become common yet. But you see, it's any which way you look at this, whether it's technologically or legally or however, we're surrounded by hostile strangers. So no matter where you go, somebody's trying to make a buck off you by trying to get your personal information.
Well,
and either they try to advise, and a lot of them anyway. And I'm going to sound like a little bit on the anti-consumerist angle, which the root of that is anti-corporatism, really. But either they're trying to advertise to you cheap Chinese crap you don't need, or they want to gossip about your life, which unfortunately now can travel literally around the world at the speed of light. Frankly, at this point, it's more than enough to encourage anyone with any remaining sense of decency to become a recluse, and I can sympathize with that.
Well, I can, too, and I think it'll be interesting on Google Goggles if the first case that goes to court involves a government agent wearing them or a private person wearing them, and I would think that the outcome in court would be different depending on which of the two it was.
Yeah, no kidding. But yeah, you mentioned earlier about pen names, and I can really appreciate how people would use aliases and whatnot, and especially considering a lot of the soft censorship that the government likes to do on the alternative media, why people would not use their legal name if they're publishing a blog, doing a video, podcast, whatever.
Well, pen names have a use. Now, one that I've mentioned, those people, John DeWitt was not John DeWitt. That was not his name. He wrote under John DeWitt. We had Publius. We had Cicero. We had all these different names back then. And the accusations that I was talking about against Jefferson and Hamilton were done under pen names. But that was against a public person still. If it was against a private person, that probably would have been breached there, but I've never run across any account of that occurring. But pen names are used to enhance the credibility, you might say. I don't know what John DeWitt does, but Publius and the Greek and Latin names that were used then were to enhance things. The Pennsylvania farmer or something like that was really a lawyer, and he couldn't hoe a row or anything. You know, he lived in the city his whole life in Philadelphia. It was, I can't think of his name now, but he was an attorney, and he went by the Pennsylvania farmer. He wasn't a farmer, but he wanted to make it sound like he was country folk so that he had something in common with most of the people in the country at that time. But they can be used for different names. Now, sometimes writers, I knew a writer when I lived in Daytona Beach. He wrote, I don't even know what books, but he used a pen name because he didn't want his family to be drawn into this. Maybe he wrote risque books and, you know, just didn't want the neighbors to know that he was writing these sexy novels or something. I have no idea. So a lot of times it's done just to obscure yourself or separate yourself, the two personas, the ones that write and the ones that doesn't. And then there's other ones that do it to get attention, like one we all know of, Mark Twain, which was a saying on the measuring the depth of the water on the Mississippi River, where he was a river pilot for years up to the Civil War. Samuel Clemens, and he was known by Mark Twain. He was called Mark by his friends quite often. If you read his, he received letters from longtime friends that were to Mark, not to Samuel. Most of them wrote to Samuel. Some wrote to Mark. They lived with that. But when we get to the modern day, the pen names are used for a different purpose, and they're used to shield people, often are used to shield people from being found out when they make false accusations. There are a lot of people on the internet that go by one name in one persona, and then they use another one to sneak into places, to make accusations and things like that. And so, you know, there's a line between anonymity and anonymity for the purpose of getting away with abuse, if you can see that distinction. And one I have no problem with. When it's just anonymity, but you're above board in what you do, it's one thing. But when you use that to breach somebody's privacy or to make slanderous or libelous statements about somebody, you know, that's crossing a line. It's a fine line, but one that that bothers me on the internet, because 1984, when truth becomes lies and lies become truths, the internet and using a pen name quite often allows lies to become truths and truths to become lies, and there's no accountability for it. So anyway, speaking of pen names, who is Sleepy Salsa, and why do you use Sleepy Salsa?
Well, I guess it's been a long time coming. Well, let me explain at least how the name originated. It was actually during my college days. I would be up late at night just studying, quite frankly. I would have difficulty with a good portion of my courses, or because the professors weren't reasonable and put way too much work, you know, within a small space of time or whatever. So I would be up at, you know, 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 a.m. Sometimes I wouldn't even sleep at all. And I would be, you know, since, you know, down here in Texas, it's pretty, you know, common to eat salsa with pretty much just about everything. It's not just chips. I mean, you know, there's enchiladas and burritos and empanadas and what have you. And a lot of times it was, you know, eating that, you know, salsa with pretty much any of that stuff that helped keep me awake and helped me get through college. And of course, a lot of times, you know, wifey would actually come and say, hey, you know, wake up, you know, or whatever. If I passed out on the couch or something when I was trying to cram for, you know, like an oceanography final or something. So that's where that came from, really. It was just a way of kind of a nod of sorts to my college years, in the sense that I survived it.
Did you coin it, or was it a nickname that was given to you by somebody that watched you eating salsa, trying to keep your eyes?
Nickname, actually.
Okay. See, it's interesting that, you know, there pen names and nicknames. There's a difference between the two. Nickname is usually given by someone else based on a characteristic of the person. You know, a common nickname is Sarge. Hey, Sarge. And the guy might never have been a Sarge, but he was a little bossy in the military. He might never have been in the military. Colonel was a very common one back in the South. Anybody who was a gentleman and had a certain number of slaves under him, or met other criteria, could rightfully call himself a colonel. In fact, I think some states still issue colonel statements to people that make campaign contributions. I guess the world's changed a little bit. But you don't do it to hide from anything, because you're always known as Sleepy Salsa. You're always above board. So at least you're not, you're just using a pen name that you like. It was a nickname that you've converted to a pen name that you like and like to write under. I've always written under Gary Hunt, Outpost of Freedom, and I have no intention of changing that. Nobody's ever given me a nickname. I guess I'm just not good enough for one. So I have to go along without one. But that was interesting. I always wondered where that came from. I thought it might have to do with something like Not Made in New York or something like that, however that commercial goes.
Well, you know, if I had another chance to do it from the beginning, I probably would just do go with my name as is. I mean, people know what I sound like anyway, so I guess I might as well just admit it. My name is Kyle. Kyle Reardon.
That is your real name? You don't have to answer that. Never mind, you're not applying for membership in the Committee of Safety.
Well, I guess it's just as real as any other name, isn't it?
Okay, so Sleepy, you're Sleepy. I'm Kyle, or Sleepy. Well, I'll stick to Sleepy. I kind of like it.
yeah, one of the seven dwarfs. So.
Especially when I've got to yell to get your attention.
Yeah, that's happened more than once.
But, you know, there's nothing wrong with these nicknames, the pen names, the nom de guerre is the French word for war names, and I still can't figure that out. Napoleon's name was Napoleon. George Washington's name was General. Oh, but I've heard nom de guerre used, and I can't put it in context unless we talk about Frederick the Great instead of just Frederick. But if they're not used for, you know, I have no problem with them if they're not used for divisive purposes. But I do have a problem when that anonymity is intended to provide immunity from doing things that are breaches of privacy of other people. If you know something about them and aren't willing to say who you are or to make accusations true or false about somebody. So, you know, there's a fine line that deals with privacy, because when that anonymity comes in, it's most often used to violate the privacy of the person that person's going after.
Right. Actually, thought just came to me about this. You know, my nom de plume is only attributable to me. it's incredibly individualistic. So I guess you could say, I guess in a roundabout way, I know that that a lot of my, dissident behavior in the past was usually anti-consumerist. But I will say in this one regard, it's almost like a brand in a manner of speaking, helps people remember the name at the very least. But it's still individualistic. It's not like Anonymous, which is a collective alias where anyone can just assume it.
Who's that Negro boxer that named all his kids the same name as his?
I wish I could remember right offhand.
I can't remember, but my wife's got a grill that has his name on it. And
oh, him. Oh, wow. Okay.
Anyway, yeah, Anonymous. Now, I don't have respect for those people because they are doing it with malicious intent. They're hiding from responsibility. And that's where you draw the line, because when you hide from responsibility, obviously that responsibility is an obligation to another person, and it's denied because you're hiding it. And how do you go after Anonymous if he says anything about you, whether truthful or not? You have no recourse, and that's where the problem arises. And I hadn't thought of Anonymous, but that is an abuse.
Put another way.
Besides, he's quite schizophrenic, man. He's got more personalities than who was that lady with 12 personalities?
I don't remember her name, but that's actually a very good point. Yeah, but it's the problem with Anonymous is kind of twofold. One is that they originally started off as a bunch of hacktivists, hacker activists. And so their common MO was usually DDoSs. But then the other side of it, and I think I was either talking to you or someone of us about Anonymous before, but you or someone else brought up the problem that Anonymous could have, like, government agents assume that collective alias and steer Anonymous toward that are genuinely destructive and not just
well, it could, it could be used by the government quite successfully. In fact, I'm sure that there's a lot of people that don't even know who Anonymous is that have assumed the pen name of Anonymous for the purpose of saying things, and this is where the different personalities come in. I remember reading some stuff by Anonymous on one Anonymous page on the internet, and I went to another Anonymous page, and they seem to have different political philosophies as well. So it's come down to anybody with a white mask and can spell Anonymous correctly is Anonymous.
Yeah, and about the mask, sorry, another thing I just thought of too was that they stole that. Okay, that's the Guy Fawkes mask. That was originally part of the V for Vendetta movie.
Well, it was V for Vendetta, not Guy Fawkes, because Guy Fawkes didn't end the way V for Vendetta did.
Well, okay, yes, there's the issue, historical issue.
Guy Fawkes didn't wear a mask either, so.
That's okay, fair, yes. There's the issue about the actual gunpowder plot, granted. But, there that movie came out, and then it was actually the libertarians really more, to use Lou Rockwell's term, the Ron Paul kids. And technically I would fall under that, except for the fact I was a bit of a heretic because I was constantly saying from the beginning, don't vote for the guy.
Well, damn, you're going fast, man. You've grown out of all those bad habits over a very long time.
Thank you. But it was really the Ron Paul kids who were first using, part of the Ron Paul Lovolution, as Adam Kokesh would pronounce it, that were actually using the Guy Fawkes mask. And then Anonymous came later, co-opted it, and now it's just known as the Guy Fawkes mask.
Well,
I remember
a number of patriots. Didn't Charles Dyer use that white mask, or did he use a different one?
He never used a mask as far as I remember.
Yes, he did early on. Maybe it was more like the goalie mask, the hockey goalie.
Oh, no. It was, okay, I know what you're talking about. When he wore his U.S. Marine outfit first. Yeah, that was it was called like a skull mask. It covers the lower half of his face. That's not the same thing as, that's not the same thing.
But now I see a lot of people using the Vendetta mask. I'm going to stick to the V mask, not the Guy Fawkes, because I read about
Guy. Yeah, the V mask. Yeah, well, I mean, that's now been co-opted because now it has nothing to do with libertarianism or Ron Paul or anything like that now, unfortunately.
V for Vendetta is definitely revisionist history.
Oh, absolutely. The issue about November 5th, you know, the gunpowder plot. Oh, absolutely. Even that socialist, Webster Tarpley, he's professionally trained. Well, by professionally trained, what I mean is he got a degree in it. But, you know, he's a historian, and even he wrote in one of his books that, you know, gunpowder plot, you know, how it's portrayed is not how it happened at all, pretty much. So even he kind of recognized that the movie really bastardized the actual historical events that a lot of the film's action is supposedly based on. It's phony history.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's the other thing, too. The only reason why Anonymous picked up on that was really because of the last part of the movie where
everybody had a mask on. Yes, yes, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. So the collective, yeah, it's the collective hive mind thing, right? I mean, because if you actually look at the character V, I mean, he's very individualistic. He's got his own mind. He's very literate. He kicks the snot out of the bad guys the entire time and stabbing them with his knives. And so you could say he's very, well, in one sense, violent, at least in a self-defensive context, I would say. You know, he's a vigilante. Anonymous is not about that at all, which is really weird for me because most of the thrust of the movie was that he was kind of a like a freedom fighter type or as some, SPLC type sycophant would say, a lone wolf. But that was what the thrust of the movie was about, not the thing happening in the last scene of the movie. And then twisting that into some sort of thing that's about hackers. So yes, it's gotten away from the point of from the original thrust of that movie. It's gotten away from, you know, the libertarians and Ron Paul, and it's now become this other completely separate thing, which is now susceptible to government agents, you know, having their way with it, as opposed to something like my alias, where if I do something. And let's say I slandered or libeled or defamed somebody. You know, my alias only applies, and it's known now, it only applies to me. Doesn't apply to 20 other people.
Right, and you
so I can be held to account.
Tracked down and held accountable. Now, let's talk about hacking for a minute, too, and privacy. Do hackers have a role in society, in warfare? We know that I think it was a printer or something that was shipped to Iran had a chip in it that spread a virus through the missile defense system of Saddam Hussein. That hacking was legitimized as an act of war against a party we were not quite at war yet at the time. That was before we started the war. By the same token, the Patriot community might want to hack government computers to get information or to throw a stick in the spokes. If it's directed hacking, perhaps it's justified. Perhaps it's justified. You know, it depends on whether it's for personal gain or being used as a rifle, as a weapon of war. But hackers in general, I've gone through this a number of times. I lost 4 months worth of work in Phoenix, Arizona, because I got a disc of some drawings from another company, and somehow that disc had a virus on it and got on my computer, and the people I took the computer to didn't save the data before they, and usually you can save the data before they F-disked the drive. And recently I ended up with what's called a rootkit virus on my computer, and I got a new computer then, and I've extracted the data off of it, and now I'll have two computers when I'm done making sure I've got all the data. But that's malicious, and those guys, to me, they should be shot without trial. So hackers can be a good thing if they're conscientious in their hacking, if it's directed. If they're going after a bank, fine, they're going after a bank. But when they go after private people and destroy private information by hacking private computers, by stealing information off of private computers, those guys deserve no mercy at all.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. The only other thing I want to mention about Anonymous that I just also remembered is that a lot of people think it's a group, and it's not. It's a tactic. It's a technique. It's actually probably the best comparison is like what especially that one anarchist I'm thinking of described the Black Bloc. You know, the Black Bloc is not a group. It's a technique where, you know, a bunch of people get together and dress in black. So Anonymous is very similar. You get together and wear the, as you would say, the V mask and walk around and protest or yell stuff or whatever. So no, it's Anonymous is not a group. It's a tactic. And I would say additionally, it's a collective pseudonym. Well, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, I'm a few things that I've read and I'm going to challenge that just a little bit. A few things that I've read, and just looking at the structure and how it came on the scene, it would appear that Anonymous initially was a group of maybe five or six, maybe a couple dozen people that through, you know, encrypted emails decided that they're going to form this group called Anonymous and do things. And then it began to manifest itself, but it was a small group of people. But then anybody could get a white mask, and as long as they could spell Anonymous correctly, could join the group, which wasted the old group, and it just kind of disappeared in the masses. But I think that when it first came out, it was too organized to have been an individual because there seemed to be a number of different hits by Anonymous at one time, obviously by the style and everything else, being different people. So that's my belief in what happened, and it makes a lot more sense that a small group got together, decided to use this persona. But then since it was Anonymous, it opened the door for everybody that wanted to play Anonymous as well.
Yeah, and really the last thing I'll say about them, actually, little known fact, on my old blog from years and years ago, not the current one I've got, the very first article I ever did, and this was when I formally stepped into the alternative media, and I decided I'm pretty familiar on the content on the receiving end. You know, I've read blogs and listened to podcasts and watched videos, but now I'm going to start actually making my own. The very first thing I did was I was actually first a blogger, and my very first article was actually about Anonymous when Project Chainology got started. And that was their series of protests and similar activities against the Church of Scientology. And actually, you know, in one sense, I hate to admit it, but it was because they used a pseudonym, albeit a collective one, that actually was the seed in my mind to eventually use a nom de plume. So I guess in that one regard, I should credit them where credit is due. But as time has gone on and they've demonstrated their good points, bad points, and ugly points as well. I guess a critique was more than an order. But yes, you're right about the malicious hacking. In some ways, it actually helps the government in some ways. Or
yeah, and it also gives the government a tool. All they need is a white mask and somebody that can spell Anonymous or have a good spell checker to act like a patriot and feed, you know, look at World War II and the invasion of Normandy, the extreme that was gone to present false information to make it appear that the invasion was going to be at Calais instead of Normandy. That misinformation is a vital tool. It was called probably the best kept secret in history. That or the atomic bomb, one or the other. These two secrets during World War II, the amount of effort that went in and the amount of misleading or deceptive information that went out. If you think about that and think that Anonymous provides the government the means to provide that misinformation. Now, we've talked about misinformation before and how it numbs people over something. And we see it all the time, but when Anonymous establishes a degree of credibility, this is not some guy calling himself Sleepy Salsa saying this. This is Anonymous saying it, and it must be true. even though.
Right. And you know, Russia Today runs so many they've gone and written several articles and news reports, video news reports, and press release, and all of it about Anonymous. So the Russians definitely, you know, try and give them credence. And it's like, you know, really, what, you know, Gary, you remember when they had The Plan, when Anonymous is The Plan? You remember that?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, we have a plan, where it's stage three of the plan or something like that?
Stage one. They were at stage one. Remember, they never got to stage two. That's right. They had, yeah, that's right. Their slogan was, I want to get this right, I'm doing completely from memory. Our plan, three stages, 1 year of change. I think that was the slogan or something very close to that.
They were in stage one right now, but they wouldn't even tell you what stage one was.
They didn't even know what it was. That was the funnier part. Anyone who went on the main website for that and looked at the forum boards, and then it turns out that they never even got to stage two. And apparently there was an internal schism or something, and then they went their separate ways. So basically, in the short explanation, without having to go through all the 20 million different details of how all that all transpired, in summation, gee whiz.
I'm going to conjecture that they never got to stage one, unlike you. You think they never got to stage two.
I think that's probably more accurate, but yes. I mean,
to get to stage one, you have to be able to identify what the stage is, and since they never did, how can they possibly have achieved it?
Yeah, no. It was the fancy recruiting video that really got people. In fact, that's how I first found out about it, because one of the guys in the Patriot community sent the video to me, got really excited about it, but it turned out to be a bunch of nothing. And so in summation, that's what it was. Anonymous is the plan that wasn't.
Yeah, plans are interesting. I just saw one the other day. I got a kick out of it. This is the plan to reestablish government under the Constitution. And first, we've got to get good people in office in Washington. Oh, that's quite a plan.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I'm going to hock back to what Randy Mack has said so many times. There is only one plan.
Right. Of course. And I don't know. It just irks me. And I know that with Anonymous, they've tried to turn that collective pseudonym.
Well, I thought we were done talking about Anonymous. Let's go on with the
private. Sorry.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, of course. But yes, I
I may go Anonymous if we don't change course.
But yeah, the constant theme I see in the the privacy advocacy literature a lot of times boils down to corporatism. You know, you have these corporations really just gathering their customers' data or tricking them into it in some cases, or in some instances even compulsory government.
Both covertly, that's what cookies are.
And covertly, and that too, yeah. And just, you know, so whether it's, give us your credit card number, or it's, you know, buy something from Amazon or whatever, it's just constant.
Well, that's where the modern issue of privacy really comes into play. I haven't read everything on the subject of cookies, but cookies at first were initially just a re-identification. So it was kind of like, okay, here's your key. You can come back to this site and we know who you are and you don't have to log in and all this stuff. And it was done quite a bit on subscription services. This is back quite a while ago when cookies first came out. But then they found out that these cookies could be, let's say, investigative cookies, and they could look at different sites that you went to, and they start getting more and more complex. And, you know, basically these are hackers. They're hacking into your computer and gathering information where you go on the web. They might even, who do you send emails to? But their primary purpose, and obviously the money behind investigating and pursuing this course, is a marketing standpoint, because, and we see it now, it's directed marketing. The pages you go to determine what advertisements you get on Facebook and many other sites. Somehow they know I'm a senior because I get all these pictures pardon the expression, of big-titted young girls saying, if you're a senior and you need this, but they're addressed to seniors. So somehow somebody there knows that I'm a senior. So it could be my birth date because I put that out there. But it's very subtle. But they've got these guys sitting down saying, well, this is what we can market to this guy. This is what we can market to that guy. And all we have to do is gather that information. And just read one the other day, which is rather interesting. You know, when I was in Arizona, I got a Safeway card and I got discounts on my purchases sometimes. And they start looking. The insurance companies are buying this information from the grocery stores. If you drink a lot of milk, you have a higher potential for cardiac problems. If you buy a lot of soda pops, you've got a threat of obesity. So they start throwing this information out to charge you more money. Their motivation is to invest in getting this information off of these discount cards from grocery stores so that they can raise your rates, justify raising your rates because you're a higher risk because you drink a lot of milk. I don't drink milk. My daughters do. But I would be shown buying milk, and so they would suggest that I have a potential heart attack risk because I buy 4 gallons of milk a week. And I have milk on my cereal in the morning 5 days a week. And probably twice a month I make a milkshake. That's the extent of the milk that I drink. But I would, if I use that card here, would be identified as a high risk for cardiac disease. That's an invasion of privacy. To sneak into my private life, seeing what my buying habits are and whether it's for giving me the directed ads on Facebook or many other pages, or determining what my health risk is for the purpose of health insurance and life insurance. This doesn't make sense. And I just found out the other day that auto insurance is based upon, what was it? Your credit report.
Why am I not surprised?
But what's the relevance? My credit report determines. Well, I would think my history proves that my payments have always been on time for 50 or 60 or 50 over 50 years.
Oh, they need it for verification purposes, I bet.
No, apparently, if you have a low credit rating, they want to raise the cost of your premium. If you're less able to pay, they want to raise your premium. Now, actuary tables are what insurance companies use to determine the premiums. So they've come up, some bean counters have come up with these ridiculous ideas that if I have a low credit score, and I have a low credit score because I don't borrow money. I don't bank. And so my credit score is probably 50 or 60 or something. I don't know. Maybe it's lower than that. Maybe it's zero. So my auto insurance goes up. And all because I don't borrow money. But I have never been late with the premium payments. Twice a year, they get the check. At least 10 days before it's due.
Well, this is what happens when you have a monetary system that's not based on real wealth and is based on credit.
It would apply even if it was gold and silver standard. What it is marketing. It's not the structure of the money system. It's the fact that these people are trying to find ways that they can rationalize charging people more. It doesn't have anything to do with the fact that we're using FRNs. If we were using gold certificates and silver certificates like they used to, they would still be doing this to increase the market value of their product wherever they could justify it. And how they justify next time I talk to my insurance agent, I want to ask him to find out for me how they justify raising my premiums for a low credit score. I want an answer to that because, I can be pretty creative in my imagination, I think. You know, I think things out. And I've been pondering this since I found out about it about 3 or 4 days ago. And it's beyond me. How can they possibly rationalize increasing my premium, not based on accidents, driving record, or anything else? And if it has to do with credit, it should be based on my history, not on credit report. I don't buy my insurance on credit. I've got to pay in advance. They do 6 months. I can't even buy a year. I used to be able to get a discount if I paid a year, but I don't get a discount anymore. So I pay every 6 months now, and it's paid on time. So I prepay for it. So credit is not a factor here at all. Absolutely not. I'm not paying at the end of the 6 months. I'm paying before the 6 months. Cash on the barrelhead is what they used to call it.
I'm sure you'll get some sort of semi-reasonable sounding legalese that will just be delivered as if he's talking about the fact that the sun rises and the sun sets. That's how.
I'm not sure I'm going to get anything that I won't laugh at.
Well, you may laugh at it, but I'll bet you dollars for donuts is going to present it as the most reasonable thing, as if it was, the sun rises and the sun sets. Well, so what's your problem? There's something weird here.
I have every intention of calling the insurance. My insurance has gone up every year. Every 6 months, they raise the rate. It's gone up $300 for a 6 month period in the last year and a half. And I haven't had an accident in 40 years.
Oh, my.
So, what's the justification for that? My car's getting older, so replacing it would cost less. So everything is working in their favor, but my rates go up.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned earlier about the discount grocery store cards. And I think a version on a theme of that that's happening or about to be happening now is supposedly with these new HD TVs that have built-in microphones in them. And supposedly with these new TVs, somebody on the other end is going to be hearing you and your family, and they're going to target advertise you. So, and the examples given were that, you know, if you're having an argument with your spouse, you'll get an ad for, you know, marriage counseling.
Well, I'd say if you have cable TV, that potential exists. But satellite, I think it would be very difficult to set up a stream upstream system for satellite, unless you plug in your phone line, which I don't do, for our satellite television. So,
well, who knows? It might be an easy way to get around it just by that reason alone, right?
Yeah, maybe the smart meter they put in out here gathers it. But I don't. I'm not going to get it. If it has a microphone, I ain't going to buy it. Just like I'm still trying to find a cell phone without a camera in it. If you run across one, let me know.
Yeah, it's getting impossible to find. I mean, I remember when I was a kid and the camera phone thing was a non-issue. I mean, that was always top of the line, the exception. Most of everything didn't have that. Now it's just ubiquitous.
And it was piss poor quality, and now you can do videos with audio and everything with them. Jeez.
Right. It's just so even like the cheapest of even the disposable phones now, a lot of them have video and it's very cheap. So that's going to be kind of a problem going into the future, is just finding one without a camera. It's just goodness sakes, really. The freaking TVs, like supposedly another example was if they hear your dog in the background, they give you ads for dog food. And actually, it's not just, and here's the other thing too, it wasn't just a microphone, apparently it's also got a camera in it. Because another example given was if they see you curl up on the couch with your spouse, then you get advertisements for like baby products or something.
Well, well, what you're viewing at the time too, and how you react to what you're viewing would be a marketing tool, wouldn't it?
Yeah, if you're yelping or you're scared or it's kind of screaming fear or whatever, you're watching a horror movie or whatever, yeah.
Creative marketing, you know, I got to interject something here. Years ago, there was a gas shortage and there was a coffee shortage, and in Orlando, Florida, there was a concrete block shortage. Now, there's an old piece called Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, or Quiet Weapons for Silent Wars, or something like that. And I read that, and it was a study in seeing how people react to certain things to be able to manipulate society. Now, the gas shortage, long story behind that, the government had plenty of gas that they'd stored in salt mines to mix with the available supplies to keep the cost of gas down. But by the time the 1981 gas shortage came up, they decided, well, we're going to keep this all for the government in case we need it. So they never used it for what they intended, which is typical of government and is typical of, like I said, on the Olmstead case, where, you know, they wrote the rules to suit themselves. They didn't have telephones then. They didn't write it in the Fourth Amendment. So screw you. You're not protected. Coffee shortage, apparently, in reading, there was no shortage of coffee, but the idea was to investigate what people's reaction would be to the most addictive and most common drug in this country, coffee. I don't drink coffee, so they didn't get any information from me, but and it was kind of a marketing one, and coffee prices began going up after the shortage, but there was never a shortage. If you read the import statistics at the time, the coffee was coming at the same rate. It was being stockpiled in warehouses. But the other one, the one that I have personal knowledge of, being a surveyor, was involved in construction. And in Orlando, we had a concrete block storage. And the price of concrete blocks went up about 60% within 2 or 3 weeks. Now, I had a job over in Tampa, Florida at the time, and I went over to Tampa during this crisis. We could not get concrete blocks in Orlando, and I went by a concrete yard there, and the concrete block was stacked so high that the forklift was having trouble getting the top tier on. The whole yard was filled with concrete blocks. There were enough concrete blocks there to build 300 or 400 houses. It was stockpiled, and here 90 miles away, there's a shortage of concrete blocks. So there can be manipulations. The gas shortage was a manipulation of sorts. The coffee shortage was a marketing one to test the marketplace, and the concrete block storage was used to increase the price of concrete blocks in the fastest-growing community in Florida, Central Florida, Orlando area. So this is corporatism. Business will do anything they can to give themselves an advantage two ways. One is stealing, you know, corporate secrets, but the other one is more along the lines of social engineering, manipulation, covert acquisition of information, and all this, and it's all for the bottom line profit. Now, this country became strong on a good product at a fair price, and that concept is nearly lost in this country. It's almost gone. There's just a few people that retain that ethic of a good product at a fair price. Everything's become bottom line. So corporate will invest millions in developing means and millions in encouraging legislation that allow them to utilize these means to invade your privacy, get on your computer. You know, that's wiretapping your phone, isn't it?
Yeah, really.
It's wiretapping your phone because, you know, computers are dial-up or other methods, but it's your communication, your private communication. It is going out of the house, but in a sense, they're tapping your phone to gather information, private, privileged information about you, to benefit, to affect their profitability, and then they get government to enact laws that legitimize this theft of private information.
Yeah, and I mean, but and I think ultimately, I guess, you know, and to kind of use the, using as a start jumping board for this, the those TVs I just described. I mean, how is that any with the microphones and the cameras? How is that in any way substantively different from the telescreens in George Orwell's 1984? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I could have sworn it's pretty much exactly the same, or very, very close to it anyway.
Well,
if that is indeed the case, aren't we now living in the age of Big Brother?
That's going to be an interesting court case, because even recently the Supreme Court, and I don't remember the case, but it was fairly recent, the Supreme Court said that inside your home is sacred, outside your home is not. I know what it was. It was a Supreme Court decision on just last week on drug-sniffing dogs. They can sniff your car, but they cannot bring them in your house, because once you enter your house, you're in your kingdom. So they can't, you know, go into to bust you for anything and not find anything, and then bring the dogs in to see if you've got drugs in the house or explosives or whatever they might be looking for. So your doorstep is the extent of their invasion. That house is still, well, let me read a quote that's in the back of the Citizens Rule Book, the one that's put out by Wooden Printers. The poorest man may, in his cottage, bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storm may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England may not enter. All his forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement. Now, that's what the Fourth Amendment was based upon, especially your home. Now, how rigid is that? The king cannot enter.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Okay, now, so when they bring, if anybody gathers information, audio or video, because I bought a television, are they not breaching that ruined tenement?
Sounds like trespass to me.
And now what the Supreme Court decision from last week on drug sniffing dogs was, it's okay in your car because you're on a public road, but it's not okay for them to bring them in your house. So that's going to be an interesting test, whether these televisions can actually be utilized. Now, there are questions, too, because some information gathered cannot be used in court. But it doesn't mean that it can't be used for investigative purposes. So you kind of a gray area there.
Very much so.
But,
but
anyway, let's take this a little further. Now, the government, as I said, is willing to enact laws to support corporations. Now, why would they do that? Well, one is they get money contributed to their reelection campaigns. But the other one is... are these businesses, these corporations, giving the government ideas, and with their software and their cookies and these different means, developing also the ability of Big Brother to intrude upon your privacy? Can they work a deal with the corporation that, we'll let you do this, but I'll tell you what, you got to give us the information we want, and let's look at banks and records, libraries and records that we've seen fall down lately. And also, it's speculated, and I think there's probably truth to it, if the Canadian intelligence agencies gather information on me by means that are illegal in this country, the government, if they get them from Canada, have not violated the law in getting that information. They just traded or bought it from Canada. So by the same token, can Big Brother then ride on the coattails of corporatism and gather information about us as a condition of the continuation of us supporting your intrusion into their privacy, and gather at least intelligence information, if not prosecutable evidence?
Right. It's all really atrocious. And quite frankly, Gary, I'm getting quite fed up with this, and it's really encapsulated really in, I guess, the slogan, very statist slogan, that basically is the sole justification for the surveillance police state apparatus, which is this. If you have nothing to hide, then why be afraid of the cameras? You know, nothing to fear, nothing to hide.
Okay, news today. Let's go to that. News today. I think it was in New York. I caught the end of it, but apparently there's a question whether this can be used as evidence in what ended up being a murder. And I think in New York that the traffic cameras picked this guy chasing the girl that was murdered. Now, can that be used as evidence in court or not? Because the traffic cameras were put up, promises only to monitor traffic so we can keep traffic flowing. Can they use that as evidence now? They can use it investigatively. That's a done deal. I mean, we know that. The license plate identification cameras they've got, a lot of them in California now that read license plates and log license plates, what intersection, what direction they were traveling, time of day, and all this is being used for investigative purposes. Now they can't use them as evidence, but they got some housebreakers and they've got some other people by these means for investigative purposes. Now, traffic cameras, the question is arising, can we use this? We just happen to have this. Can we use it as evidence in court to show that this guy was chasing this girl that was murdered? Now, let's get into deceptive justification. The argument is the only way we can convict this guy of murdering this poor girl is to be able to use that information that we gathered only for the purpose of controlling traffic. But just coincidentally, we picked up these images of him chasing her, which proves that he was in pursuit of her shortly before she died. So, if they're allowed, and I think it's a state court that's going to deal with this first, if they're allowed to use that as evidence, they have just broken that barrier by using deceptive justification. They have broken that barrier, just like the Social Security card, not to be used for identification, $50 fine for misuse of this card. They got in the door. They got their inch. Now they're going for the mile. And my guess is, because the Constitution means so little nowadays to the government, that they will eventually rule that that traffic camera can be used as evidence in court in the murder trial of this guy for killing the girl.
Yeah, so, and then
there's always this justification on the part of government. The one on Social Security, well, for credit reporting purposes, see, it used to be identification was this, name, date of birth, and location of birth. That's all they needed to identify somebody. But now they want your Social Security card. Credit reports used to be based on name, date of birth, and location of birth. Those are unchangeable. And the possibility of a coincidence is almost non-existent. And it can't be falsified like a Social Security number. I just read today that they've got somebody apparently has proof that Obama's used two Social Security numbers, none of which was issued in Hawaii or where he happened to be at the time. One was from Connecticut, and I don't know where the second one is. But they used the argument to get their foot in the door, to get that first inch, and then they begin shifting things because it facilitates something else. And see, it's a benefit to you. After all, we had to lie to you because we knew this was going to be a benefit. We knew where we were going. It was planned from the get-go, just like that gas that was stored in the salt mines. We got to justify the expenditure of tens of millions of dollars, and this is back in older dollars, back in the 70s, I think, to build take these salt mines and outfit them to store gasoline in so that we can keep the price down if there's a shortage of import supplies. But then when there's a shortage of import supplies, they say, okay, well, we're going to say this for the government because if we're going to be in a world of hurt with, you know, the millions of employees we have driving cars all over the country and trucks and things like that, if we don't have gas, so, you know, you're on your own. You're going to have to pay more for your gas. Everything the government does, the social or the Federal Reserve Act, I think it was called the Aldrich Bill in 1910, was kicked out and it was rejected by the people, and they had problems with some parts of it, which were subsequently removed initially in the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. But it accomplished two things. They found out what was too objectionable to add at this time. We'll add it later. And for 3 years now, people got to talk about, well, this bank, this whole Federal Reserve System, we got used to the idea. It's just like we did with NAFTA. Nobody challenged NAFTA on it being unconstitutional. It's not really a treaty. It's a violation of the sovereignty of this nation. But we got used to the idea. It got bantered around, and even Ron Engelman, when I was in New Mexico and went on his radio show, it was going to be about Waco, but he spent 15 minutes talking about what he didn't like. He's a patriot, but he was talking about what he didn't like about NAFTA and things should have been taken out. So the discussion was not whether NAFTA was constitutional. It was, this is conditioning. It was about whether, what are the bad points that should be removed from the bill? And when they're done arguing, hey, most of them stayed in anyway, if not all of them.
So, yeah, but isn't he implying? Yeah, but wasn't he implying though that there were certain parts in NAFTA that were good then?
Well, that's what's left. Yes.
Well, that's not very patriotic, at least in any sort of genuine sense. But
no, it's not. Yeah, this is the methodology of government. The tactics are to bring it in under one guise with the intention of changing it down the road, and the other one is the rationalization of the necessity of the expansion of the application. For example, the traffic camera, I think it was New York. I'm going to have to find that story.
Sure. And I see what you're getting at with you've been bringing up about the Social Security card. And it actually kind of makes sense from the government's point of view if they're going to push the surveillance police state apparatus, which is the Orwellian nightmare, the legal, your own personal legal identity documents, everything from your birth certificate to if you're male, selective service card, to driver's license, to voter registration. For some reason, you have to get one of those. To pass, your U.S. passport. All of these documents, Social Security card, obviously. All of these documents overlace and flop on top of each other. I mean, my goodness, if you try to go and apply for something as simple as a driver's license, for whatever reason you do that, then you have to have, like, they have the list of primary documents and secondary documents, just paperwork on top of paperwork on top of paperwork. So, on one hand, it might seem like it's not centralized, but then if you actually, just a fun little, suggestion I've given to people before is that you don't think that you're being tracked and traced just in terms of your legal identity documents alone. Just take one evening, get out all of them. Go, put them on the table, just one right after the other. Your birth certificate, Social Security card, driver's license, passport, etc. And really just look at what's in them. Everything.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the birth certificate. I mean, that's the one that says where you were born, the day you were born, and what your name is. I mean, that was the principal form of identification. There's a lot of concern about speculation about what the birth certificate serves as, and I don't buy it. I think the idea of a
the issue here is that there's so many documents you have to have. I mean, it's not just a birth certificate, even though that may have been the case before. It's just so much stuff. I mean, you have to have your papers, please. I mean, how many of us have been asked for our driver's license and passports when approached by a cop?
Yeah, let's go back to another area of deception that's rather interesting, and it just occurred to me. Do you have a Social Security number, Sleepy? Yeah, I don't want to know what the number is, but do you have a Social Security number?
Yes.
Do you have a bank number?
Yes.
Oh, you don't have a bank account number.
Oh, excuse me, that's what I meant.
Okay, we'll see what happened there, because looking at the old Social Security cards, it said your Social Security account number is, and then in big red letters, it gave the numbers, your Social Security account number. And the reason I say this is the only time I've used Social Security number for anything in the last 30 years is for employment. I have not given it out to anybody for anything, no matter what. I've had some hassles in dealing with some utilities and things like that. Nowadays, my wife uses hers. But the point is, I don't have a Social Security number. That's a brand, I guess. I have a name, but I don't have a Social Security number. I have a Social Security account number, just like I have a bank account. I don't have a bank account number, but if I had a bank account, I wouldn't have a bank number. I would have a bank account number. The account is what it's identifying, not me.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't think about that before.
So when I tell people I don't have a Social Security number, they say, everybody has a Social Security number. I tell them I have a Social Security account number for the purpose of employment and Social Security, but I'm not going to give it to you.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, it's just all of these deceptive justifications, but especially the one I would say about, well, if you've got nothing to hide, then what do you have to fear from all this very intrusive surveillance? And you mentioned earlier about the traffic cameras. I mean, those are, I remember as a kid that I never saw a camera except in some stores. Now they're just ubiquitous. They're on the roads and
the ones in stores were, well, when I was a kid, if there were any in stores, I mean, video was not available then. But when they first came in stores, they were fairly large objects, too. But now these traffic cameras are pretty damn small. You know,
yeah,
six inches long, an inch and a half in diameter, and that's it. Not counting the mount, of course, but they're extremely small, and they could be smaller. I don't know why they're as big as they are. Maybe they want you to see them. I don't know.
Yeah, and see, that's the awful thing. I mean, they're all over Austin here. Like,
but we're used
everywhere.
To it because it's to control traffic.
Well, supposedly that's what they claim. And this is the worst, and this is probably the worst part, at least for me personally. I can look out my window at the nearest intersection, and I can literally see the cameras. There's actually about three of them pointed in different directions. So I can literally look out my window and see the police state in action.
No, I look out my window and I see a stop sign about 600 feet away at the corner of my property, and it's a stop sign.
Hmm. Well, unfortunately, I guess on my end, I mean, that's guess one
well,
of the
when I go into
of
town,
urbanization.
When I go into town, I see them, and they're there, yes, and they're all over. And New York wants to get them on every street corner.
Oh, dear God, why?
Well, I think to come up with evidence for prosecution of criminals. Maybe it's for traffic control, but you wouldn't need them at every intersection for traffic control because, you know, there are patterns in traffic. So
yeah,
it must be for crime. It's not crime prevention. It's, you know, we've gone through this before. You cannot prevent crime. You can only punish crime. So it's not crime prevention. It's crime punishment that they're putting them in for. They'll call it crime convention, but I have never seen a camera stop a crime.
Yeah, and in fact, actually, whenever there have been suspiciously violent events of any flavor, one feature I've noticed that's pretty common is that the cameras for that period of time when the suspiciously violent event is occurring always just seem to either the tape's missing or it doesn't work or the government has it but they're not going to release it or when they do or if they do happen to release it, it's always edited from the portions of when the suspiciously violent event occurs. So, yeah, you're completely right.
We've got to thank Richard Nixon for the 13-minute gap in his tapes. That goes back a long time ago. Most of you won't recognize that.
Right. And it's funny you should mention about, punishing crimes. I think what you really mean is when the government wants to prosecute people for violating mala prohibita.
Well,
you know,
murder is a little more than
well, that's all I'd say, sure.
But yes, it eventually will extend to that. I mean, look at they're getting turned around now, but the citations that were issued for running red lights, they take a picture of your car, they send you a ticket, and you're expected to pay it. Now, people have been fighting that, and they have been winning them, and a lot of cities have stopped doing that. Now, let's look at the marketing behind that, though. These companies came out, invented creative ideas, came out with these cameras that would were sharp enough to identify the license plate. And if they could identify the license plate and see that he would had run a red light, that they just automatically, you know, here's the license number, and then some clerk sits down and types it up and sends them a ticket and says, send us $150, you ran a red light, and here's a picture. That wasn't initiated by the cities. That was initiated by industry that managed to deceptively justify as a source of revenue without any manpower requirements except a secretary to type up the ticket, and raise millions of dollars a year in a large city. Many millions of dollars in a large city. So a lot of times the motivation for this will come from creative industry that's not looking at a good product as a fair price, but creating a market where none exists. Now that's good. A lot of people have done that. Sam Walton did it. Sears did it. A lot of people have created a market where a market doesn't exist, but when that market begins to invade our privacy, then I got a problem. Sears didn't invade my privacy. They allowed me to buy things via mail order from anywhere in the country. Sam Walton initially bought American-only products and was proud of it until he died and his children got greedy and started buying all Chinese product. I don't think I can find anything made in the United States in Walmart anymore or Sam's Clubs. But these guys are creating a market and deceptively justifying a demand to the city by saying, look, it'll cost you $10 million to install these, but we guarantee you'll make $30 million the first year. The city says, hey, that's $20 million in revenue. Let's do it. And if they won't do it the first time, the guy says, I'll tell you what, you put $1 million down, and then you can pay, after the first year, you can pay the other $9 million. You know, they'll market it just to get it on the streets. So a lot of times it's the greed motivation that is instrumental in these objectives that eventually diminish our privacy even further. So we've right. got both government and corporate business in bed together for the sake of a dollar, moving in the direction of destruction of privacy. Every bit of it either has, well, even on the criminal side, for the most part, mala prohibita, the revenue that's generated justifies the invasion of the privacy by these various means.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know, I just thought about the sociological and some psychological research that has come out that has demonstrated, more or less, at least I think it's at least halfway decent or accurate, that people who know that they're under surveillance act completely different than they would if they didn't know they were under surveillance. And so, like these traffic cameras, and I am emphasizing that for a reason, because they are ubiquitous. And I do pay attention to where they are, you know, around Austin. They, how can you have any sort of community, genuine community, if everyone is under the lens like they're a friggin' lab rat? I mean, that's what it feels like here. And since most of the, most of the countries, yeah.
Some people are aware of it. Most people aren't. They just, they don't change their pattern. Yeah, the scientific observation that an observed object adapts to the or reacts to the observation. Most people don't. And this is the numbing process, because a couple cameras go up at critical intersections, and they're just traffic monitoring. And then a few more go up. But people see them and traffic monitoring, oh, that's fine. A few more go up. And after a while, they don't even look up anymore. They don't notice them anymore. It's kind of like chemtrails. People say they're doing these chemtrails. I've got pictures of chemtrails from the 40s before there were jet engines. Some of the larger reciprocating engines, their exhaust was enough. Now, a jet engine or a turbine engine moves a hell of a lot more air than a reciprocating engine. It requires this flow of air through the turbine, where a reciprocating engine sucks it in, runs it through the cylinders, and so you're only getting so many cubic inches each revolution So you've got enormously greater volumes and enormously greater heat differentials between the particles. But people don't look up. And when somebody says chemtrails and they start looking up, I never saw those before. They must have started spraying around us. But they've been around since I was a kid. So same thing with the cameras. People just don't, they're not aware they're there. They've been numbed down to the fact that they're there because why concern myself with it? Because they're there to provide traffic control.
Yeah, that's not the purpose at all.
As you go from a small handful of cameras to hundreds or thousands, how many is it going to take to do every section in New York or every intersection in New York? I mean, that's a lot of cameras.
Yeah, quite a bit. In fact, there's also those surveillance nests, they're called, when you've got like 3, 4, 5 cameras pointing in different directions. They're on the same pole. It's also known as a surveillance nest. But yeah, considering, you know, the prevalence of these, you know, supposedly traffic-only cameras, you know, even if you do, even if someone who is trying to see through the fog does manage to go to a local political meeting, or they just, hell, I can.
Well, the license plate identification ones, it would be easy to determine who went to this meeting. To take all the license plates that go down these intersections around where the meeting's held, and then the next meeting, get all the license plates, and then collate this. Okay, where do we have license plates at both meetings? Third meeting. Okay, which license plates were all meeting? Yes, they have. With those license plate identification ones, they have identified the commonality of these three meetings at three different locations, who the participants are.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that. But yeah, that would only take a little bit of number crunching and some footage, obviously. But, you know, regardless of whether people actually try and get together in their own local areas and try to build, you know, communities, you know, there's that problem too, obviously. But then even if you've got the other end of it, where you've got folks who, and I can definitely sympathize with this, who've just become, like I said earlier, recluses, and they just do stuff on the internet only, and they try and develop a kind of, I hate to use it, but a kind of digital-only community. Well, that's a bit stretching it. I don't know how much of a community you can have only over telephone wires. But they try to do that, and don't get me wrong. I mean, the internet's great for, you know, getting in contact with people who live outside your own area.
Most
but
not even over telephone wires anymore. It's low power radio transmissions.
Okay, then primarily then. But then I've noticed that, you know, people trying to form their own crypto communities, I guess, and unfortunately they come across, you know. It's only a matter of time until you have somebody who steps on the toes of somebody else, either because they were impolite or they were just being obnoxious or whatever. And next thing you know, you've got some pretty bad infighting going on. And the reason I bring it up is because I've noticed infighting over the years, especially over the internet particularly, but also in, look, you know, wherever I've lived too, especially when you have two dissidents really going at each other in front of, very publicly in front of the entire group. And if it can get downright nasty, I mean, I've seen stuff where, people's physical addresses and telephone numbers and legal names are released on the internet, like on one of these so-called social networking sites or Ning sites or what have you. And obviously they try to make pains to not even have their legal name out there because they, like we mentioned earlier, they try to use a nom de plume. And so the problem, another problem of infighting, come to think of it, is that if it gets particularly nasty, and usually at some point it does, if it goes on long enough usually, is somebody's privacy gets violated big time by their opponent.
Well, if you're a cop and somebody publishes your name and address and where you live and all that information, you can go to jail for it. You know that? I think I've known a few people that have gone online with the government employees' information and been prosecuted as a consequence of that. But then that's the government you're going after in those cases.
Right. They've got sovereign immunity and all this kind of stuff. Well,
Sleepy, I think we've got a lot more to talk about, but it's getting close to my bedtime tonight, so I think we're going to have to pick up the, you know, there's a lot to talk about on privacy, and we've kind of alluded to some of it in our discussions in the past, and I think we ought to close for the night, and then we'll pick it up maybe tomorrow night and
That's perfectly fine. Well, hey, thanks, Gary. I do appreciate it. And you definitely, and thank you for mentioning some of those kind of more historical bits. I'm starting to really kind of get an idea for how the cage is put together.
What's
so
that
you.
Saying about reliving?
I don't remember exactly, but yeah.
Those who, how does it go? Ignore the past, end up repeating it, or something like that.
Yeah, those who ignore the past risk repeating it for the future.
Yeah, and that's why, to me, it's so important to understand what the social and political and the technological, if you want to call it that, background is to the laws we have. I mean, that whole thing on Olmsted is what bothered me and got me really interested in, you know, let's look at what their intention was. And I think when I read the Fourth Amendment, I think it's pretty clear what it meant, that you have, at least in your home, have privacy. Persons, houses, papers, and effects. Now, effects, would that be your car or not? Because, see, they've decided that your car is not. But I wonder if a carriage was then. And I haven't run across anything that addressed a carriage. But, you know, I think we've just touch the surface on privacy, because we've got to talk about where we give up our privacy voluntarily, and to what extent should we give up that privacy information voluntarily. And I think we also need to talk about, to stay on this subject, we need to talk about means of protecting your privacy. So, like I say, it's getting a little late, and man, I'm going to fall asleep if we try and get covered those areas tonight. So I think, like I say, let's pick this up tomorrow night.
That's perfectly fine. Well, hey, Gary, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Have a good evening.
Good night.